accession number 18041, Reel 1.
This is a recording of a conversation between Jock Bryce and Jeff Montgomery at Brooklands Museum on July the 25th, 1989.
I started here as an apprentice in 1944. And first got to Wisley around about 47, 48. But having said that, I should really say, for continuity's sake, my own father started here in 1908. So I had grown up as a child with Brooklands and all that that meant, both aircraft and the racing track. But around 1948, at Wisley, we had a lot of leftover aircraft from the war. We had quite a few people who had been with, test pilots who had been with the company during the war. And it was around about that time, 48, 49, I think, Jock, that new faces started to appear, yours, Brian Trubshaw, and one or two others. And if my memory serves me right, at least one of you appeared when we had to vacate Wisley, at that time flying Viking, because the runway was waterlogged and we had moved to Lasham. Do you remember?
Yes, I went to Lasham shortly after I arrived here.
Now, that experience went on with having to move out of Wisley. Parts of the winter. Another time we went to South Marston, if I recall, with the Viscount. And it really was not until about 1950 that you were the boss and the big decision was taken to close Wisley and get a new runway put down where the Valiant and Viscounts and others wouldn't keep going through the grassy surface. So at that time you moved us all down to Herne for about a year. Is that right?
Correct. When was Wisley actually built? I mean, was it too thin a runway for the weights of aircraft you were using?
No, it was a wartime field built around about 1941-42 as an alternative to Brooklands, if I can put it that way. Where most of the flying took place. I think probably if one dug back far enough, it was all part of the concept of a dispersal, of not having everything on site here, bearing in mind this place was bombed in 1940. And incidentally, during World War II, in addition to Wisley, there was a Wellington assembly factory and a runway at Smith's Lawn at Windsor.
That's right. But presumably, I mean, here at Weybridge, you had a runway.
No. Weybridge was also a grass runway.
A grass field?
Grass field,
you
yes.
You take off in all directions.
Mm. And likewise, so was Wisley. Although you know, there was a basic direction to go at Wisley, and it wasn't until the Valiant came along in around about 1950 that it was realised A, that Wisley just had to have a proper surface, and B, that was followed by Brooklands being surfaced for the first time with a concrete runway.
Mm. So when you came here, Monty, you came as an apprentice then, did you?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. And what areas of the workshops were you in? I mean, did you cover the whole manufacturing process as a broad education?
Yes, through the if you like, the fitting shops, the machine shops, assembly, flight sheds, and also served for a time at Wisley as an apprentice. That's going back a bit. That was in the days of the Warwick. Some of the remedies that were used on with hindsight were very practical, but for example, the overbalance rudder on the Warwick, in order to get the maximum possible rudder control for coastal command purposes, where they wanted to turn on a sixpin, so to speak, the aircraft was flown with the rudder movement being controlled by big eccentric stops, which were made out of very hard rubber. So one rotated these stops to give a little more movement until the pilot said, no, no, that's enough, because it was about to become overbalanced and get locked in. That was my very first encounter, really, with Wisley.
And the Warwick was a development of the Wellington, was it? A modernisation of it, or a totally different design?
Now, essentially a development of the Wellington. It should have been the successor with more powerful engines, and at the same time, at Manchester, prior to the Lancaster, they developed the Manchester, which also was a twin-engined aeroplane, but I think both of them proved to be not too satisfactory because one was coming up to that time the limits of the piston engine itself. At Manchester, they went ahead and had put in four engines, and that was the Lancaster. And here we were, for whatever reason, somewhat slower, and there was a four-engined aeroplane, also with geodetic construction, called the Windsor, but that was at almost the very end of the war, and its design was particularly long-range for use in the Far East, where, of course, it wasn't needed. The war came to a sudden end, and that was the end of the Windsor. But stemming from the Wellington rather than the Warwick came the Viking. And the very first Viking civil airliners, about 1946, had Wellington wings with the inner plane covered by a sheet metal instead of fabric, so it didn't get burnt off if there was a flash from the engine. The outer wings and the tail were all fabric covered on the very first aeroplanes, and then progressively they got covered in with metal wings and metal tail planes and so on. And before we started this recording, you may recall Jock saying that progression carried on because we went through from the Viking, the Valletta, to the Varsity, which is now standing outside the window here. And the Varsity was the first aeroplane with, I think, Jock, metal controls.
Yeah, first Vickers aeroplane.
First Vickers aeroplane.
We metal control.
Metal control surfaces, yes.
Yeah. I say that, but it's 40 years ago.
I think you're right.
Yes, I think you're probably right, but it's getting to be a longish time ago, but I'm sure that was, in its own mild way, quite a step forward for us, because it made, particularly on the production line, the repeatability, was so much better than a fabric-covered surface. We were advancing in these days, my lord.
Can I turn to you, Jock, for a minute and sort of ask you how you came to Vickers and what your early jobs were?
Yes, I was an RAF pilot, and at the end of the war I was posted to the King's Flight at Benson, where they were going to operate four Vikings, and I inherited the third Viking, and that was my introduction to Vickers Weybridge. And after 6 months in the King's Flight, Mutt Summers offered me a job here as a test pilot. And I can well remember in his office when he offered me the job, I had to smile because I didn't know the first thing about test flying, and told him so, because I'm quite sure he was getting me mixed up with someone else. And he said, No, the offer stands. Do you want the job here as a test pilot? So again, I said, I don't know anything about test pilot flying. And he said, we'll teach you. So I was in quite a predicament then, whether to continue on a very good job in the RAF or whether to join Vickers. And I honestly don't quite know what prompted me to go the Vickers way, because I was a regular Air Force chap. I'd been into the Air Force before the war, and I was a career Air Force pilot. I decided to join Vickers, and I was very pleased that I did, because I had some 20-odd years of the most interesting flying anyone's ever had, as far as I'm concerned. So that was the reason why I arrived at Vickers in 1947. Although in 1946, remember, we had the problem with the overspinning propellers on the Vikings.
Right.
I was sent down and took one of the airplanes out to Khartoum with Hugh Hemsley. And I remember I got a kick out of it because I was an RAF officer then, but I went out in civilians. And it's the first time I'd ever flown an airplane with a pair of flannels on, and it didn't have to be peculiar. Halfway down between here and home to clear customs, Hugh Hemsley and Jack Dunkley, remember him?
Yes.
Lit up a cigarette, and I almost jumped over the side because I had never, ever seen a cigarette being smoked in an aeroplane, and I was rather under the impression that if you lit a cigarette in any aeroplane, it was a loud flash, and that's the end of it. It was quite interesting flying in civilian clothes. Felt quite unusual.
Did you ever go back and do an ETPS course, for instance?
No. Summers wouldn't employ anyone who was ETPS qualified.
Really? Why so?
Because we had one or two unfortunate incidents down there, and I'm talking vintage 46, 47, 48. We had two RAAF students flying a Viking or a Valletta, and they took the fin and rudder off the aeroplane, destroyed it and themselves, and Mutt was a little bit of the old school that you couldn't learn test flying in a lecture room, and a textbook, as far as he was concerned, was no substitute for going through Martlesham Heath in yesteryear. One of the old school. So he would not employ an ETPS graduate. It's extraordinary when you look back on it now. But these were the days of, you know, Mutt had learned how to fly. If you discuss the various generations, there's four generations of pilots. There's the pioneers. Stand to attention when we, you know, the Blériots and the A.B. Rose and the Tommy Sopwiths. Then there's Mutt's generation of pilots. Mutt and George Liddell, they learned to fly on rotary engines and finished up on jets.
Unbelievable.
It's quite a step. My generation of pilots learned to fly on Tiger Moths and finished up flying supersonic airplanes. And the third generation are the space boys, the NASA boys, who learned to fly virtually on jets and go into space. Now, Mutt was rotary engines to jets, had been test flying for many, many years at Martlesham Heath and at Vickers since 1929. He just couldn't cope going down to Farnborough and listen to some brilliant, well-qualified, experienced RAF flight lieutenant pilot talking about the theory of test flying and such like, because it had all happened to Mutt the hard way. And he had one of these mental things that he wouldn't fly. The other pilot who was reputed to have been in the same frame of mind was Rolly Beamont of English Electric. And I was once at a McKenna dinner where he was the guest of honour, and he made quite a point of saying that was not a correct statement. He had to defend himself. But there was a little bit of a, if you looked at the fellows he employed up there, he didn't have it here.
I think as a flight test engineer, one, maybe we were wrong, but we had the impression that Mutt believed in flying by feel, by the, so to speak, the seat of his pants. We had another thing that we started to get in another generation of pilots, and some of whom would take a Viking off from Wisley and climb up through some cloud and press on to wherever they were, whatever they were going to do. That, to the best of my memory, Jock, did not appeal to Mutt at all, nor to George Liddell. If you couldn't see the ground, you shouldn't be flying. And the Mutt, I recall, had an expression which related to, it simply said, it's only birds and fools that fly, and birds don't fly at night. The newfangled blind flying panels and things like that weren't for him, and I often have suspected that these chaps coming out of ETPS and so on, they knew basically more than he did when it came to that sort of thing.
Well, you're absolutely right there, Monty, but I remember once flying in what with Mutt. Might have been a Valletta, and we had a mild case of rudder flutter. It would build up, and before you could do much about it, it would die down again. And if you accelerated, and it wasn't divergent.
Mm-hmm.
And Mutt said, slacken off the spring tab. Sam Richards was chief air there, and just joined the company. And he said, no, we'll tighten up the pretension. And Mutt said, okay. So he and I went off and up over docking. We got the appropriate speed. He gave it a kick and away it went. Back we came. Tightened it up a bit more, and he tightened it up so much after 3 or 4 days that it was still fluttering, but you couldn't get sufficient rudder on at the appropriate times because the spring tab was virtually locked. So they said, let's have some spoiler tubing down the tab. That'll tighten it down. And Mutt said, no, I'll tell you what we want to do. We want to slacken the pretension. Take it back to where it was, then we'll take some off. And Sam Richards looked at it. And Mutt and Sam messed around, and I went along on all the co-pilot trips, and eventually, in desperation, they slackened it up a few tons. No flutter. And Sam was a big enough guy and all the rest of it to say, what was the thinking behind that, Mutt? And he said, we had that in a Stranraer in 1931, and that's how we cured it. See, and you can't beat experience. He had seen it all before, and he could remember a case on a bloody flying boat down at Southampton, way back, when I say 31, maybe it was 35, but he said, that's how we cured it then.
So seat of the pants flying still comes in. I mean, you remember that American Airlines captain flying a DC-10, and the door gave way and a coffin flew out. Do you remember that?
I do indeed.
And he lost his third engine and all his tail controls. And but before that, he thought to himself, what would happen if this happened? And he went into the simulator and learned to control the stability of the aeroplane just by the two wing engines.
Mm-hmm.
And then this coffin incident happened, and he saved the aeroplane. Just like this guy tried to the other day in Sioux City. I mean, that's seat of the pants flying still, isn't it, really?
I just don't know what he had to go on. Presumably not very much, but he certainly did a wonderful job.
Mm. But that particular generation, after Thunder the Wild, must have been 1950, the prototype Viscount 630 was put into service for some celebrations on London, Edinburgh, and London, Paris.
That's right. It was routing.
It was carrying fare-paying passengers after the first celebratory flight or two, but there had to be a Vickers captain on the flight deck, and I recall it was George Liddell was flying it, and there was a navigator on board, Bill Fell, who said to George, you know, stay on that heading, you know, and George turned around and said, but Bill, there's some cloud coming up. And you know, it was sheer willpower that kept that chap, as far as he was concerned, you turned away and you went round the cloud. You didn't go through it or over it. Mm-hmm. This is what I'm trying to emphasize between the two generations. there were not two generations, but the two approaches.
Well, this was all before the advent of ground-based navies, really. I mean, you had no VOR in those days or anything like that.
George, a few years before I joined this company, he once told me a story of the first aeroplane he ever flew with RT. And it was an envoy, an airspeed envoy, down at Portsmouth Way. I don't know why he was flying there. Well, he used to work for Duncan Davis at Brooklyn, that was why. And he was told to use this, so it was a highly complicated bit of machinery as far as he was concerned, headphones and a switch and a volume control in one channel. And he said, I often look back in shame because I switched it on, it crackled and popped, and I picked up the microphone and said, hello, Liddell here.
That's really good. What's called a radio telephone after all?
Hello, Liddell. It's like an old chap we used to have at Wisley. He used to visit us, and he was a pain in the neck. He must have been 80 if he was a day. And he was one of Cody's mechanics down at Lapham's Plain. Remember, he lived out in Virginia Water?
Yes.
And he used to bring in a photograph of himself being as a passenger with Cody. And he's sitting, there had no seat, so he was straddled on the wing, holding on to a strut, between the fuselage and the strut, with one of these hats with the peak at the front. And some guy at Wisley said, I've almost got his name, I thought in these days, ha ha ha, you had to fly with the peak at the back. He said, we hadn't thought of that at that time, we just used to lose caps until some bright chap said, let's turn them round 180 degrees and they won't blow up. Do you remember that chap?
Mm. Yes.
Lived in Virginia Water.
Can I go back to you, Monty, now and just ask you to tell me how you became involved in flight tests as opposed to working on the ground all the time?
After doing an initial period at Wisley as an apprentice, I then moved back to, in fact it wasn't to Weybridge, it was to Brooklyn's house, where the design office was located, and I stayed there for about 9 months.
Where was this?
Just on the other side of the railway, but this is the home of Hugh Lock King, which is now Brooklyn's college. And we then moved down to the newly built design offices here at Weybridge, and I was here, I guess, for another 4 or 5 months, and I approached the boss, Henry Gardner, to ask his permission if I could go back to Wisley and spend some time in flight test. And he very graciously said, yes, you can, but I would expect to see you back here in about 5 or 6 months. And in fact, I came back, about 9 or 10 years later, and he never really forgave me for that. I think it's really one falls in love with the end product in the end. Apart from the odd trials and troubles, I think it was a superb sort of life.
This would have been the Viking, your first aircraft, was it?
Yes, the Viking, and then Valletta, Varsity, Viscount.
And in those days, observing meant what? Filling up pages and pages of readings on...
Either if it was a deliberate... a development aeroplane, one was sitting at usually at an observer's panel operating an F-24 camera and so on. Relatively, I think, sophisticated at that time because one was weren't doing it remote from the crew or the pilot. The other form of flight testing was very often production flight testing, where you were standing behind the pilot, taking note of his comments and reading his instruments and engine instruments and so on, with a clipboard and a stopwatch. But again, it sounds very crude by today's standards, but looking back on it, I don't think it was at all crude.
It was a big advance in what had been going on 5 years before our time and 10 years before our time.
And my own feeling is that of all the post-war aeroplanes that were produced. The greatest advance in so many ways was with the Viscount, because, just to give you an example, on the performance side, the aeroplane had to be fully accountability on temperature and on altitude, and you jolly well had to go off and prove that the aeroplane, its performance was there, say flying out of Khartoum to get the high temperatures and flying out of Johannesburg to get the high altitude, or Nairobi. Prior to that, there was a lot of by guess and by God on the aircraft performance. This now similarly with the landing performance of the Viscount. For the first time, really, there were some very strong rules, and it is fascinating to look back, that when the aeroplane, Sir George finally sold it to, well, first of all it went to TransCanada, and then it was sold into the States to Capital Airlines, it was the American authorities who were learning of the certification of turbine aircraft from the NARB, but it was a jolly exciting time in the sense that you were no longer guessing. I mean,
weren't turbines more sensitive to ambient conditions than piston engines?
Yes, because we didn't know quite enough about them compared to piston engines. And if I can just go back to a point Monty made there about the certification of the Viscount, exaggerating it a little bit, in 1937, when Vickers produced the odd civil aeroplane, which they did, it was more or less, well, it must be all right because Mutt likes it. And that was all right. Mutt has thrown holy water on it, so it's got to be A-OK. But 10 years later, in the Viscount, we in fact were controlled by international law, international legislation, that we met certain requirements. Presumably the governments insisted on this, and more important still the insurance companies who were carrying enormous risks on them, so we had to fly to the internationally controlled rules to make sure that we met these requirements. Now when it came to turbines, to answer your question, I think it was a much more difficult thing because the legislation people weren't quite sure what questions they should ask, and we weren't quite sure what sort of answers we were going to get.
That's right.
And the Dart was a jolly good engine to start with as far as we were concerned, because it was basically the compressor and turbine of a Derwent off the Meteor.
You say it was a jolly good engine to start with, Jock, but I do recall the very first Darts that we had. Offered them. We fitted them to a Wellington at Wisley, and I do remember somebody called Jock Bryce really, really cross about the whole thing, because
that was terrible. They were underpowered, but when I said it was a good thing, the engine itself, now how do I best put this, the engine itself took a lot of developing, and it was a typical Rolls-Royce engine, basically lots of trouble, but they handed the development over to Lionel Hoth.
That's right.
Hats off to him, South African. And he developed that engine, and he had the guts of simplicity and reliability in the basic Derwent compressor turbine assembly.
He was the Rolls designer, wasn't he?
Yes.
No, he was the Rolls development engineer.
Yeah.
And that's where Rolls shine. None of us know the names of Rolls-Royce engine designers. All the well-known names that we know are the development engineers. And I think Rolls were quite clever in our era of giving it to a bloody good development.
Well, I think probably we had some people of the same ilk. People who, because things weren't perfect first time round, could pick up the problems and work at them and achieve perfection. Because you really get the most credit is for getting yourself out of trouble but fast. And considering how new that was, the whole concept, by 1950 to have gone into service carrying fare-paying passengers, albeit on a limited basis, was quite something. And I mean, I think we at Wisley were sort of still somewhat in awe of this little Viscount 630 taxiing out from London and flying over to Paris and so on. That sort of operation brought it home more than most things.
Because it was a combination of a new airframe and a new engine, which usually isn't good news.
That's correct.
Mm. I mean, it was a pressurised hull aircraft, wasn't it? The Viking was
a lot of new things. Mm. Although it wasn't the first pressurised Vickers aeroplanes, because a lot of the Wellingtons had been pressurised.
Yeah.
But it was a dangerous combination, and it didn't work too well in the Vanguard, come to think of it. But the Viscount was basically a sound airplane, structurally and all the rest of it, by these standards. Well, it's still flying now, so it's not going to be too bad. And this was an engine which Monty quite rightly says we had problems on it to begin with, but I think the basic concept was first class, and Lionel Hollett very quickly made it an impressive aeroplane. And we had a big bonus on the airframe there, because the complete lack of vibration and such like must have helped our the maintenance problems and the ancillary equipment and such like. I think